This is the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The Supreme Court has ruled in favor of the Bush administration, corporations, and an anti-abortion group. Series of decisions coming down today. This predictable, I guess. These 5-4 decisions, where this is, you know, they say elections have consequences. Barbara Boxer's famous statement to James Inhofe when he was trying to filibuster her on the Environment Committee. And, yeah, elections do have consequences. And one of the consequences is that the president gets to appoint Supreme Court justices. And here we have now these 5-4 decisions where the Reich wing in the court is standing up and taking over. I mean, just, you know, real simple, very straightforward. They're doing it. The EPA's responsibility to protect the Endangered Species Act weakened. This good summary of this, by the way, over at the Center for American Progress's blog, thinkprogress.org. In a 5-4 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that the federal government can avoid its responsibility to protect species under the Endangered Species Act by handing off authorities to the states. The EPA routinely delegates administration of the Clean Water Act to the states. The court's decision means the EPA does not have to ensure that the states are actually abiding by the Federal Endangered Species Act when they issue Clean Water Act permits. Wildlife Association, the case was National Home Builders versus Defenders of Wildlife, and a companion case. And hang on just a second here. I'm sorry. The Huffington Post keeps rebooting at me and blowing my screen off, so we'll just turn it off. Ordinary taxpayers cannot challenge faith-based initiatives. Here, George W. Bush has decided, without an act of Congress, that he's going to give billions of dollars, and in fact has given billions of dollars, to his religious buddies. This, the fulfillment of the fear of James Madison from his first ever presidential veto of his administration, James Madison, the fourth president of the United States, when he vetoed a bill that would have given money to a local church in Washington, D.C. to care for the homeless and the poor in Washington, D.C., saying that this was a secular issue and therefore it should be handled in a secular fashion. That is to say, the state should be doing it. By the way, secular does not mean atheist. It does not mean anti-religious, or it does not mean non-religious. It means separate from religion, or basically the secular. I mean, it's the collective people. It's government. And so George W. Bush, large chunk of his base, the Christian Taliban, or the Taliban faction of Christianity, let's say, he decided, hey, let's hand these guys billions of dollars. Well, Congress, you know, probably the Republican Congress would have been pleased to do it, but they didn't have to, because he simply created the thing out of nothing with an executive order. And in the last election year, the 2006, well, 2004, I thought was most interesting, when he was running against John Kerry, that year over $1 billion of federal money went to right-wing religious organizations. And in a 5-4 decision today, the Supreme Court barred ordinary taxpayers from challenging a White House initiative helping religious charities get a share of federal money. Taxpayers group called the Freedom from Religion Foundation sued 8 Bush administration officials, including the head of the White House Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, objecting to government conferences in which administration officials encourage religious charities to apply for federal grants. What they were actually doing, the Bush administration was actually running around the country saying to these religious charities, here's how you can get federal money. Wouldn't it be nice if they'd, like, be running around the country saying to, for example, high school graduates, here's how you can get federal money to go to college? And $1 billion is a mind-boggling amount of money. That's enough money for about 40,000 students to have full four-year scholarships. If, you know, we're seeing an example of that here in Oregon because of a conservative initiative that was passed by the Oregon legislature when it was under Republican control some years ago. If there's a state surplus, this is a super truncated version of it, but if there's the appearance, actually, of a state surplus, it has to do with projected budgets, then the in income tax revenues, and that's given back to the taxpayers, and it's coming out to a little over $1 billion this year. It's going to be given back, most of it, obviously, to very wealthy individuals in the state of Oregon. And the Oregon Center for Public Policy did an analysis, and they said, you know, first of all, $1 billion, if each dollar was one rung in a ladder, in a standard ladder, it would be a ladder from you know, Portland, Oregon, to the moon, to the surface of the moon. That's the kind of quantity we're talking about. And that, you know, and just, you know, laid it out and said, and by the way, this is enough money for over 40,000 kids to have, you know, young people to have full four-year scholarships to Oregon universities. And I'm guessing it would be the same to any state college anywhere around the country. So that kind of money being passed out to religious organizations, and the court, in a 5-4 decision, another 5-4 decision, says, no problem. No problem. This is the Hine versus Freedom from Religion Foundation. And finally, weakening campaign finance restrictions for corporate and union-funded ads. In a 5-4 decision, the court loosened restrictions on corporate and union-funded television ads that air close to elections, weakening a key provision of a landmark campaign finance law. The court upheld an appeals court ruling that an anti-abortion group should have been allowed to air ads during the final 2 months before the 2004 elections. This case was the Federal Election Commission versus Wisconsin Right to Life. So the bottom line, this is one of the reasons why it is so important that we get active and we get out there and we get involved right now in what's happening with the 2008 election. That we build an infrastructure, that we get involved, that we show up, that we participate. And why I think, you know, Jim Dean's organization, Democracy for America, is doing such an incredibly cool job getting out there and getting ready, getting, you know, getting people on the ground. They're doing these trainings all around the country on how to be an activist, how to get active in your community, how to sign people up. You know, and it's not part of the Democratic Party. It is nonpartisan. I was the keynote speaker at one of these programs when they came here to Portland. And it's just a great weekend training program. They're doing all kinds of really cool stuff all around the country. DemocracyForAmerica.com, I believe, is their website. And just one example of many organizations. Because what we have now is a Supreme Court where George W. Bush has put two young Reich-wingers onto this court, and they have flipped it. The Supreme Court has flipped. And we are seeing now decision after decision after decision, 5-4, where this whole thing, stare decisis, right? The established order, the precedent of previous decisions, this concept at law that, well, if courts have traditionally ruled a particular way, then only something really extraordinary and radical should cause us to overturn that traditional view of things. That's you know, stare decisis in a nutshell. And Scalito, I like to call him. Alito and Roberts were both asked, is, you know, stare decisis important to you? Will you follow that doctrine? Will you keep to the tradition of the Supreme Courts in following legal tradition, in following legal precedent? And they both said, oh, absolutely. You know, stare decisis, this is critical stuff, really important. Yeah, absolutely. No, nothing to worry about here. And it turns out that ain't quite the case. And time after time after time now we're seeing these 5-4 decisions, and we've got a couple, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg has had cancer, and she's not a spring chicken, and John Paul Stevens in his 80s. If we get another Republican president and we get one or two more right-wing, particularly young, healthy, right-wing Supreme Court justices, it could transform the landscape of this country and empower the Reich for a generation or more. I mean, more than that. You look at the damage that was done, for example, by the court in 1896, you know, with the case that upheld segregation. And, well, for that matter, 1886, Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad, although the decision didn't say corporations have human rights, the clerk of the court wrote it in, and subsequent courts in the 1890s held that, and the courts have held that ever since. You just look at the incredible damage that's been done by right-wing courts. How long, for example, it took Franklin Roosevelt, it took him almost two complete presidential terms to get the Supreme Court kind of on his side. This is a big deal. 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Now I might be old-fashioned, but I believe it's true that folks around the world are pretty much like me and you. I have a silly notion if we want them to be friends, they prefer that we don't torture them. But I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
Unforgivable.
I'm a liberal.
He's a liberal.
I'm a liberal.
He's your typical liberal.
And proud of it. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. A lot in the news. Mr. Cheney, Vice President Cheney. Well, increasingly we're starting to wonder, is he the vice president or is he the president, with this Washington Post series where we find out that Alberto Gonzalez, for example, who we thought was Bush's guy, right? He was his good buddy brought with him from Texas, sits there and hears arguments from his own staff about an issue, I believe, as I recall, it had to do with the illegal wiretapping operation. And his own staff says you should not do what Cheney's staff wants done. And Gonzalez says, yeah, we'll do what Cheney wants. And over and over and over again, Cheney getting his way. Condi Rice finding out 2 years after the fact about some of these intelligence matters and going in and just absolutely raising hell. But, you know, there's nothing to be done. Hey, you know, Dick Cheney wanted it kept secret from the Secretary of State. Excuse me, from the National Security Advisor and from the Secretary of State, Colin Powell. I mean, it's absolutely bizarre. And then he says, oh, and by the way, you have no right to examine me or my papers because I'm not part of the executive branch, so I'm not covered by the Congress's right of oversight. Well, then, you know, let's have the Congressional Ethics Committee investigate him. Dianne Feinstein on this. Good idea to turn it off.
In my view, this is the height of arrogance. I, the vice president, don't have to abide by any law, any act of Congress or any executive order, particularly, and I serve on the Intelligence Committee and have for a long time, the laws as it relates to intelligence. And I find this just amazing.
Yeah, I find it just amazing as well. Juan Williams basically laying the thing out. Juan Williams, the commentator on public broadcasting.
This is all a dodge. This is a game in order to, I guess, keep Dick Cheney in some kind of secured, undisclosed bunker of his mind so that he can't let the American people know what's going on with their government and how decisions are made. He won't tell people who's visiting his house, who's visiting his office. Scooter Libby is letting people know who works for the CIA as an ape. This is ridiculous.
Yeah. So Scooter Libby can out people, but Dick Cheney can't be outed. Juan Williams, absolutely right.
That's unreasonable, Senator, to say that the vice president is part of the executive branch?
No, I think he is a part of the executive branch.
Well, he doesn't.
Yeah, see, this is Trent Lott on Fox News. I mean, it's all getting very strange, my friends. It's all getting very, very strange. So we have Mr. Cheney. We have the Supreme Court. A lot of these issues here. Charlie in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Charlie, what's on your mind this morning?
I remember a quote from Plutarch. He's talking about Anacharsis in the 6th century B.C. He said, written laws are like spider webs. They'll catch, it is true, the weak and the poor, but will be torn to pieces by the rich and the powerful. You know, the Supreme Court, the way they've stacked it now, I really appreciate the point you made, too, that they made all this fine-sounding noise about they want consensus and that they'll abide by stare decisis. But as soon as Alito and Roberts are in there, it becomes exactly, you know, they're indulging all their worst tendencies. And every area, I mean, it's really frightening. Every decision lately has been 5-4. In each case, it goes the wrong way, whether it's freedom of speech or separation of church and state, the abortion, the environment. And we're going to be stuck with these guys for a long time unless something changes. It's really scary that this is, you know, this is how they got their power. That's the real irony. You were talking about this last week. They selected this guy, Bush, that it would have harmed him to count the votes. That was Bush.
Well, and in fact, and John Roberts was part of that process. I mean, John Roberts was down there in Florida. He used to clerk for Judge Rehnquist, and Rehnquist, of course, the head of the Supreme Court at the time of the Bush v. Gore case. Rehnquist down there prepping the lawyers who were going to argue Bush v. Gore before Rehnquist, before the Supreme Court, and training them in how to argue with this guy, or how to argue to this guy, rather. And you know, he's paid off by being put on the Supreme Court. It's pretty mind-boggling, really, when you think about it. All these guys who were part of that pinstripe mob, you know, including John Roberts being promoted. You know, John Bolton was down there banging on the windows. He becomes U.N. ambassador, and on it goes. A number of them became even U.S. attorneys. It's just mind-boggling. Thanks a lot, Charlie, for the call. Gene in Manhattan. Hey, Gene.
Hey,
gotta
how
take a
you
break
doing?
In just a second here. What's up?
How you doing? I'm glad you brought up the issue of stare decisis. By coincidence, I was talking with a friend of mine who's a staffer for a moderate Democrat on the Hill over the weekend on the phone, and we were going back and forth about what's going on with the court, and he and I were actually both talking about stare decisis and a couple of rulings that have already come down that broke with precedent. And he and I focused on a simple fact. Roberts and Alito lied under oath. That is
yes.
A high crime and a misdemeanor.
Well, and according to the new biography of Clarence Thomas, which was profiled in the New York Times last week, he did it as well, and extensively lied under oath.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I'm not going to raise the I word right now, but I think your listeners ought to consider maybe getting the facts and telephone numbers of their representatives in Congress and let them know. Roberts and Alito lied under oath. What are you going to do about it? If you live in a Republican-controlled area and they're a Republican who voted for Clinton's impeachment, remind them that lying and perjury are very serious crimes, as we know from Bill Clinton. And if you live in Arizona, get a hold of McCain and ask him how he feels about the Supreme Court.
Right, and you can, yeah, indeed. And you can, yeah, indeed.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
What you are, just come on.
Hey, Air Americans, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. Join the Tom Hartman blog and start blogging. That could put you in the running for our daily giveaway at the end of today's show. My producer, David Poole, in a totally whimsical fashion, will pick the comment of the day, from our airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. It could be a serious comment, quick, funny one. That person will receive an autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, which is just now out in paperback. Blog with us over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and check it out. It started in May. There's a couple of what are being treated as relatively small stories in the media right now that I think are really, really big deals. And this is one in particular. Salon.com, Glenn Greenwald writing about it. It's been, you know, blogged about by over at the Daily Kos. Barb in Maryland noted. It started in May that George Bush started referring to insurgents in Iraq, the people fighting against us, the people who are trying to throw us out of their country, the people who reflect the public opinion, the majority public opinion of Iraqis. Every study done shows that the majority of Iraqis think it's acceptable to shoot Americans. They, you know, no country likes to be occupied. We won the war. We really did. I mean, we engaged in an active war against Iraq. We took down their government. We took down we took possession of their governmental structures, their governmental institutions, their governmental buildings. We put our people in charge of all facets of their government. We destroyed their army. We found their and killed many of their leaders and imprisoned many of them. We won the war. When George Bush gave that speech on the aircraft carrier, he was right.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
He was right. We won. That was May of 2003. Then began the occupation. And as the occupation ground on and on and on, and it was done in the finest tradition of conservative thinking, that is to say, let the free market decide everything. There's no role for big government here. And so we cut food subsidies and we closed down 200 government-owned industries. And we continued the law that Saddam Hussein had put in place, outlawing labor unions. And we did away with domestic content laws that used to be on the books in Iraq that protected Iraqis, businesses and whatnot. And we said, any corporation can come in here and do anything they want in Iraq, no problem. And all these foreign corporations came in, and then Halliburton took their division, Kellogg, Brown, and Root, and reincorporated it in the Cayman Islands, as I recall, and so that they didn't have to pay U.S. taxes on the hundreds of billions of dollars of your and my tax dollars that we're giving them on the profits that they're making in Iraq. And they started bringing in labor from Sri Lanka and Bangladesh because it was cheaper than local Iraqi labor. And the Iraqis at this point said, hey, we don't like this. We don't like your conservative paradise, thank you very much. And they began an insurgency, fighting against what they perceived as the occupiers. And starting in May, relatively recently, it was just last month, George Bush, in one speech in May, used the phrase Al-Qaeda no less than 27 times in an Iraq speech. Nobody pointed out that it's not Al-Qaeda we're fighting in Iraq. It's Iraqi insurgents. And it's really weird how the storyline is changing. Today's USA Today. U.S. to reward Iraqi tribes. Leaders turn on Al-Qaeda. The U.S. military is exploring creative ways to offer financial aid and other support to tribes that have turned against Al-Qaeda or want to protect their neighborhoods. All of a sudden, it's all about Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda has been mentioned over and over and over again, constantly, everywhere. In Christian Science Monitor. That was an older one. You look at these new art, the recent reporting from the New York Times, for example, repeating over and over again, talking about the operational commander of troops battling to drive fighters from Al-Qaeda with Al-Qaeda from Baqaba said Friday that 80% of the top Al-Qaeda leaders in the city fled before the American-led offensive began earlier this week. Say what? The article then uses the term Qaeda an additional 19 times to describe the enemy we are fighting. Qaeda leaders, Qaeda strongholds, Qaeda fighters, Qaeda groups, the Qaeda threat. This is the subtle way of trying to reinvent the idea that Iraq had something to do with 9/11 because Americans have figured out that 9/11 had something to do with Al-Qaeda. And to make it look like somehow we're beating Osama bin Laden without going after him. By the way, for those of you, I mentioned on Friday Ann Coulter would be with us today. Her handler called and confirmed that she would be on the program 40 minutes ago. We'd be calling in, didn't call in. Called back 10 minutes ago, said she would be on the program in 10 minutes, never called in. So, some people are just scaredy cats, I guess. Anyhow, the U.S. military ultimate goal, back to this thing in Iraq, this is fascinating. The U.S. military's ultimate goal is to encourage the tribes, many of which are composed of former Sunni insurgents, to join Iraq's army and police forces. The bottom line here is that what we are doing, forget about Al-Qaeda, what we are doing now, let's for the moment set aside the discussion of Al-Qaeda or not Al-Qaeda. What we are doing now in Iraq is we are starting to give money to Iraqis rather than to Halliburton, rather than to Blackwater. The effort comes amid complaints by the Bush administration that Iraq's Shiite-led government has been slow to reach out to Sunni groups on its own. Lieutenant Colonel Rick Welch, a division staff officer who had worked with the tribe, said the military is establishing regulations that would allow commanders to dispense aid more quickly. Welch cited several options under considerations. One, security contracts. The U.S. military has tentatively decided it could hire a security company composed of tribesmen or other groups to protect a building or other site as long as the group is licensed by Iraq's Interior Ministry. In other words, now, 4 years later, we finally figured out what should have been obvious from just looking at how the Marshall Plan worked, that you hire locals, you build local infrastructure, you build local business, even in the security business, have locals protect locals, and they're not going to shoot at you anymore. So, number one, security contracts. Number two, medical assistance. When some Sunnis in the Amariya section of Baghdad recently clashed with Al-Qaeda militants. So here we go again. How do you know they're Al-Qaeda militants? If they're Sunnis in that area, they're probably clashing with Shia. The U.S. military provided medical help to wounded fighters, Welch said. So we're helping the Sunni tribes. Well, it's the Sunni tribes who, up until this point, we have been calling Al-Qaeda. I mean, this is where it gets so very strange. Cash payments, rewards already have been offered for intelligence tips. Condolence payments could be made to families of tribesmen who were killed while fighting. It's in the Abu Ghraib area of western Baghdad. 900 members of two tribes, including a Shiite group, are set to receive accelerated entry into the Iraqi police force and will provide security in their own neighborhoods. Why? Well, now we're paying them. So we've got these two threads going on at the same time. One, the insurgents are being reinvented by the New York Times and other mainstream media in the United States. They're picking up the language that George Bush started in May. I mean, I guarantee you this was a very intentional strategy that probably came out of the offices of Frank Luntz and Karl Rove to replace the word insurgent with the word Al-Qaeda. And the New York Times and other mainstream media, USA Today today, going right along with it, with no evidence whatsoever because they don't have any reporters outside of the green zone. The only source of information they have is the U.S. military, and the U.S. military, the Pentagon, part of this administration, they're feeding this stuff out. So, number one, set it up that it looks like the insurgents are Al-Qaeda. And number two, reduce the level of insurgency by bringing the people who were shooting at us into the fold by giving them jobs. You know, just like the best anti-poverty program is a job, the best anti-crime program is a job. And you could argue that the insurgency, in a way, is sort of crime, in the context of, hey, it's outside of the realm of normal and acceptable social behavior, at least by our definitions. And so we're giving them jobs, we're bringing them in, and it's working. Which brings us to my final prediction, which is what I've been saying now for some time, and that is that the Democrats are preparing to fight the 2008 presidential election, both in the House, the Senate, and the White House. They're preparing to fight it based on the unpopularity of the war in Iraq. And I predict that by November of 2008, the general perception in the United States will be that the war in Iraq has been, you know, or the occupation of Iraq has been largely successful. Because finally the Bush administration is doing what they could have done 3 years ago and saved the lives of several thousand U.S. soldiers and hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. And simply said, okay, we're going to go back to using government like government. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
Baby, do you understand me now? Sometimes I feel a little mad. Don't you know that no one alive can always be an angel? When things go wrong, I seem to be bad. I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Oh, Lord, please don't let me be misunderstood.
9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. I mentioned that there were three stories that were really drawing my attention. I don't know how to say it beyond that. And, you know, we started out with first, obviously, what's happening with the Supreme Court, which highlights the importance of the presidency. People say, ah, it's just the president. You know, he doesn't make the laws. No. The presidency, having the presidency is a really important thing. And it's one of the reasons why I'm very concerned about a possible Bloomberg candidacy, third-party candidacy, which would probably pull more from the Democrats than the Republicans. Bloomberg always was a Democrat. He only became a Republican to run for mayor of New York because Giuliani was so popular post 9/11. And, you know, basically, if you were a Republican, it helped. But now he's an independent and he's talking about running, and a very real possibility he could become a spoiler in that race. So anyhow, number one, the Supreme Court and the importance of the presidency. Number two, this whole thing about how in May, George W. Bush, you know, repeatedly, 20-some-odd times in a speech about Iraq, used the phrase al-Qaeda. And now the New York Times and USA Today and all the major media, all the mainstream media, they're all referring to what used to be called insurgents as al-Qaeda. And we're seeing a strategy that will, I predict, succeed in drawing down our troops. And it's just a common-sense strategy that we should have been pursuing 3.5 years ago. It's just the ideology of these guys prevented them from doing it, in my opinion. So that's the second story, which again ties back to the presidency. Because if the Democrats keep thinking that they're going to win by going against Bush on the Iraq war, I have a feeling they've got a big surprise coming. And the third is, and again, gets to the presidency, and this is one I haven't mentioned yet, and that's the GOP caging operations. And here now we have another U.S. attorney. This is Alex Acosta. He's the U.S. attorney in Ohio. 4 days before the 2004 election. At that time, he was an assistant attorney general working for John Ashcroft. 4 days before the 2004 elections, he sent a letter to a federal judge in Ohio. This judge was trying to decide whether or not to allow the Republican Party to challenge 23,000 mostly African-American voters. They were caging. The Republican Party sent out letters to 23,000 African-Americans. Well, actually, they probably sent out letters to 100,000 or 200,000 African-Americans. Probable Democratic voters. And, I mean, these letters take a variety of forms. Sometimes they have a card inside that says, you must return this card to certify that you are registered to vote. Other times they simply say, you know, if undeliverable, please return. Do not dispose of. And so if somebody is in Iraq, for example, the letter gets bounced back. Or if they're in college, the letter gets bounced back. Or if they think that it's junk mail and they don't send in the postcard, whatever it may be, the Republican Party ends up with what they argue is proof that this person isn't a real legal voter. Even though there have been fewer than 40 cases of actual vote fraud in the United States prosecuted in the last 6 years, this is their issue. Vote fraud. We got 23,000 suspects here. Even though that's, you know, so here's this federal judge, and the Republicans come to him and they say, okay, we did our caging operation, even though it's against the law. Even though, you know, the Republican Party has been operating under a federal restraining order preventing them from doing this. It goes back to Nixon. They said, we did our caging. They didn't call it that, obviously. We did our caging operation, and we got 23,000 African-American voters that we want to prevent from voting in Ohio. We want their votes to be challenged. So when they show up at the polls, after they wait in line for 10 hours, they will be told that they have to go home and get proof that they actually live where they say they live and that they actually are legally registered and entitled to vote. Or they'll be given a placebo ballot, a provisional ballot. And by the way, the provisional, over 100,000 of them, the provisional ballots from the 2004 presidential election in Ohio have still not been counted. So this judge, this federal judge in Ohio was trying to, the case was before him, whether or not to let the Republicans challenge the credentials, the voting credentials of 23,000 mostly African-American voters. And the guy who is now the U.S. attorney in Ohio sends a, quote, unusual letter, end quote, arguing that, well, as Robert Kengel, the former deputy chief of the department, the voting rights section, said, who served under Acosta, he said the letter amounted to, quote, cheerleading for the Republican defendants. The Republicans being accused of, you know, hey, this is caging, this is wrong. Which brings us back to, we need to be looking at the U.S. attorneys who did not get fired. You know, Mark Crispin Miller suggests that there was between 4 and 5 million votes stolen in the last couple of election cycles. And caging was one of the principal techniques that was used. It was documented by the BBC back in the 2000 election. Between privatizing the voter rolls, as was done in Florida with Choice Point, and the caging operations of the Republican Party, you had hundreds of thousands, probably millions, but clearly, identifiably, hundreds of thousands of Americans who have been thrown off the voting rolls, and they are still off the voting rolls, and they don't know it, because they cast a provisional ballot, not realizing that it would never be counted. So Congress has just figured out what the word caging means. The Democrats in Congress apparently have just figured this out. And they better get on this thing, and they better get on it quick, because this is a big deal. And this is the heart of the whole U.S. attorney scandal. And again, it's not being reported on by the mainstream media properly. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. This is Air America Radio.
It's June 25th, and on this day in 1938, Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, signed the Fair Labor Standards Act, a piece of legislation that strengthened the Wagner Act that further extended the rights of labor, in part because he had seen, I mean, this was part of bringing us out of the Great Depression. His original observation.
I see one third of a nation ill housed, ill clad, ill nourished.
And so he set about to change the rules of the game of business in such a way that a middle class could emerge in the United States after nearly 100 years of, for all practical purposes, there not being a middle class in the United States, with the exception of the family farm. Greg Brecken is with us. He's a project scholar with the New Deal Project. NewDealProject.org is the website. Gray, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Tom.
Tell us about the New Deal Project.
Well, it's actually the Living New Deal Project, and it's based here at Berkeley with the Institute for Research on Labor and Employment. And it got started about 3 years ago, and the Living New Deal Project is a collaborative effort. We hope to have people all over the state involved in this to inventory, rediscover, and map the whole physical legacy of the New Deal, and then we want to spread it to the rest of the country. And it's incredibly exciting, actually, because when I started this, like everybody else who gets involved in this, I had no idea how much there was. And I'm just blown away, as does everybody who becomes involved in the project, at how much there is around us and how beautiful it often is and how indispensable it is to our daily lives.
Yeah, modern America, and certainly the American middle class, is very, very much a consequence of the New Deal. Had it not existed, most of what we look at around us would not exist. I mean,
absolutely. Most people don't realize most of our airports, for example, were built by the WPA. About 85% of them, by the time of the war, were actually built by the WPA. Our water systems that bring us water, that take our water away, storm drains, courthouses, public libraries, our whole public school system really came into shape at that time because there was a big earthquake in Long Beach in 1933, just 6 days after Roosevelt's inaugural, And the WPA and the PWA came in and completely rebuilt the Southern California school system. But then they went on to essentially build the whole public school system in California and throughout the country, too.
Yeah. This, you know, the New Deal, I think, is a brilliant illustration of the classic divide between liberal and conservative thought in America. Conservatives believing that the only purpose of government is fundamentally to protect us from evil people, that is, to field armies and have police, because they think that, that people are essentially evil and therefore the primary purpose of government should be to restrain people, and that because people are evil, corporations, being morally neutral, are superior to people, and so if you just throw everything over to corporations, everything will be fine. But because people are evil, if you allow institutions run by a large number of people, like a democratic government, to run things, you're going to have problems. And liberals, believing that people are essentially good, would say that a morally neutral organization, institution like a corporation, needs to be, at the very least, watched very carefully because it's inferior to humans, and that government, democratic, small-d democratic government, that represents the interests of the majority of the people and that acts on behalf of the majority of the people, actually is a force for good, because that's the nature of humans. On the front page of your Living New Deal Project website over at newdealproject.org, Gray, you have a quote from April 14, 1938, Franklin Roosevelt: "The only sure bulwark of continuing liberty is a government strong enough to protect the interests of the people, and a people strong enough and well enough informed to maintain its sovereign control over the government." This idea that the purpose of government is not just to protect us from evil people, but is to help us, each one of us, achieve our very highest potential.
Yes, I completely agree with Roosevelt on that. And, of course, he realized that you couldn't actually have a democracy unless you had a strong public education system. And that's what's behind the building of all of these schools and libraries and museums and such, to have a well-informed electorate. That was enormously important. And, of course, the neoconservatives, they're the ideological descendants of the American Liberty League, which was set up by very wealthy people, particularly the DuPonts of Delaware, at the beginning of the New Deal to stop Roosevelt and the New Deal. Their ideological descendants have largely destroyed the American public education system. And, of course, that then leaves democracy itself very much in doubt if you don't have something like that.
Yeah, one of my big concerns is the great purge that happened during the Reagan years in our high schools of civics, where there was, I mean, it's going on in our colleges now. David Horowitz is leading the charge.
Oh, absolutely.
But in the 1980s, they were running around going, these teachers are all union members. They must be communists. And these textbooks, they talk about the Wobblies, and they talk about the history of labor, and this is communist stuff. This is socialist stuff. And we got to get this out of our textbook. And the textbook manufacturers and publishers were so intimidated that you've got kids graduating from high school today who'd have no idea who the Wobblies were. They have no idea who Joe Hill was, and yet, arguably, the labor movement, the progressive movement, in the 1860s through or 1870s through the 1930s was one of the probably one of the three major forces that shaped this country.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the New Deal was, among many other things, it's a celebration of labor. You know, it gave dignity to labor, to people who work with their hands and their backs and who just do hard work. And since then, of course, labor is, it's almost been shrouded in shame. But when you look at the New Deal public, the art, for example, in our post offices and such, when you really begin looking at it, you see that it really is about giving labor dignity. And today is the anniversary of the Fair Labor Relations Act, one of the prime pieces of legislation that came out of the New Deal.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Fair Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was. That's right.
And this was like an addition to a step beyond the Wagner Act of 1935 that first established the right to unionize.
Mm-hmm.
Is this when the National Labor Relations Board, I thought that was created with the National Labor Relations Act in 1935, the Wagner Act. Did this empower it? What did, you know, this anniversary accomplish?
Well, this one?
No.
Oh, well, it established minimum wage and maximum hours. And so it actually begins the creation of a mass middle class, because, you had to have at least subsistence wages, when you were doing the kind of work that those people did. But I'm actually not that interested in that part of it. I'm interested in the physical remains of the New Deal and in teaching people as a geographer, which is what I am, to see the landscape in a different way, and by seeing the landscape in a different way, that is all these physical projects, then to begin thinking about governance itself and civics in a different way.
Yeah.
And I'm very gratified when I give these talks that people come back to me and say, I'm seeing all sorts of stuff I never saw before.
Yeah, for example, you said you talked about the airports.
Oh, well, you know, here in the Bay Area, the Bay Bridge, which actually was begun under Hoover but completed by the New Deal, Treasure Island, the amphitheaters that we have, all the schools that I mentioned, our airports, our water systems, our park system. Our park system is largely the creation of the enormous amount of labor that was available through the Civilian Conservation Corps and the WPA.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't realize that. In the research I did, I found that virtually all of the parks in San Francisco were largely created by the WPA, and I suspect the same would be true for New York City and all around the country.
Yeah.
The baseball diamonds that we have, the picnic grounds, most of that comes from the New Deal.
Here's Franklin Roosevelt calling a generation to involvement, to action.
There is a mysterious cycle in human events. To some generations, much is given. Of other generations, much is expected. This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny.
You know, he really meant it. He really believed in an America where the citizens were empowered and were active and helped create that.
Yes, I think, you know, he was imbued with the whole idea of the social gospel. This man was a true Christian in the sense that he believed in social justice and in helping people. I think a lot of that comes from his own affliction with polio. You really feel that when you go to Warm Springs, Georgia, that people down there just love him.
Yeah,
because it gave him compassion. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, I've been there, and yeah, there's, his ghost is there.
Oh, absolutely. It's everywhere, and it's really inspirational to be there. And listen to that voice. I mean, the projection of optimism, of hope, in one of the darkest times in our history, and then compare it with what we have now, with a president who can scarcely speak the English language.
Yeah, don't get me started. Well, actually, you did. I'll continue it after the break. But Gray Brecken, the website is newdealproject.org, the Living New Deal Project. Good luck on your work. It's a great thing you're doing.
Well, thanks very much, Tom.
Thanks for being with us today. 16 minutes past the hour. We're going to hear from Franklin Roosevelt in just a moment.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Listener-supported radio. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen for the sponsors on your local radio station that you can support. And let them know that you're listening. For that matter, let your radio station know that you're listening. And also, thanks for your support of our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, smalldog.com, the Organic Wine Company, 1-888 Eco Wine, and Purina One Natural Blends, 1-866-380-MEOW. So, much appreciated, your support of our program, by supporting our sponsors and letting the radio stations know that you're listening. Franklin Delano Roosevelt, 1936, when he accepted his second term as president. People say, it's interesting, sometimes I get emails, particularly from conservatives, who say, you know, why do you keep talking about Roosevelt? He's dead. You know, I mean, this is, the famous, Limbaugh thing, you know. He's dead, you know, get over it kind of thing. But, it's...
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And that's the point. His policies do live on, and it's his policies that created the modern American middle class. And when they're destroyed, the middle class is being destroyed along with them. And I think that, therefore, it's really important to understand what it is that Roosevelt said and what he did as a consequence of what he said. Talking about freedom. Bush runs around talking about freedom a lot. Roosevelt had a slightly different, a radically different understanding of freedom.
That very word, freedom, in itself and of necessity suggests freedom from some restraining power. In 1776, we sought freedom from the tyranny of a political autocracy, from the 18th century royalists who held special privileges from the crown.
So then we were fighting against the British East India Company. Now it's something new.
But since that struggle, man's inventive genius released new forces in our land, forces which reordered the lives of our people. The age of machinery, of railroads, of steam and electricity, the telegraph and the radio, mass production, mass distribution, all of these combined to bring forward a new civilization, and with it a problem for those who sought to remain free.
Free!
For out of this modern civilization, economic royalists carved new dynasties. New kingdoms were built upon concentration of control over material things. Through new uses of corporations and banks and securities, new machinery of industry and agriculture, of labor and capital, all undreamed of by the fathers, the whole structure of modern life was impressed into this royal service.
These new economic royalists, Roosevelt talking about.
Private enterprise, indeed, became too private. It became privileged enterprise, not free enterprise.
And this is the essence of the entire thing. He's saying freedom has to do with economic freedom. It has to do with the right to stand up to the new imperial order, the new economic royalists.
The royalists I have spoken of, the royalists of the economic order, have conceded that political freedom was the business of the government, but they have maintained that economic slavery was nobody's business.
And see, I would say now even they're even saying political freedom is not our right.
They granted that the government could protect the citizen in his right to vote,
which is being taken away.
But they denied that the government could do anything to protect the citizen in his right to work and his right to live.
This is where Roosevelt gets into the importance of government involvement in the marketplace.
These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power. Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power.
Requires the overthrow of this kind of power. Do you get it? I mean, this is a sitting president of the United States standing up to the robber barons, to the largest corporate powers in the United States, saying these guys are the new economic royalists, and our duty as Americans, because we believe in freedom in the United States and in small d democracy, our duty is to overthrow this kind of power. And that mentality stood until 1981 when Ronald Reagan came in and initiated the new conservative era. And for 26 years, we have been going in the wrong direction. And as a consequence of it, the middle class is being wiped out. 27 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
It's still here. It's still alive. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Now, in fact, the way that Roosevelt wrapped that speech up was talking about we can't have mob rule and we can't have a tyranny of the overprivileged. Right? In other words, yeah, the concern of some of the founders was that we don't want too much democracy because then you'll have mob rule. Well, that's one of the reasons why we have a representative democracy in the United States. But also, what Roosevelt was concerned about was rule by the overprivileged as well as the mob, the rabble. And this is how he ended the speech.
In vain, they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
He's talking about the economic royalists.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection.
And there you go. And I would just add one final little bit of FDR nostalgia, and then we'll move on.
We're not a warlike people. We've never sought glory as a nation of warriors. We're not interested in aggression. We are not interested, as the dictators are, in looting. We do not covet one square inch of the territory of any other nation.
Boy, how times have changed. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. There's some breaking news in the election transparency, the election fraud arena, and I want to get into this in some depth as we continue on with the program, probably in the next hour. But first, Marty in Los Angeles. Hey, Marty, welcome to the program.
Yeah, Tom, along the lines of what you were talking about the Supreme Court a little while ago, what scares me is the fact that Supreme Court Justice Stevens is 87 years old, and Justice Ginsburg has had some health concerns,
right.
And the next president could appoint their successors, which means to me,
almost certainly will.
Oh yeah, and which means to me that for the rest of my life, because I'm almost 60, I'll probably have a conservative Republican Supreme Court, and that just appalls me. But what you were saying before, how important the presidency is, I go back to next year's election, and I think that when I hear guys like Carville and McAuliffe and Begala, you know, with this Hillary Clinton love affair, I think that she has a wonderful chance to win the nomination and almost a nil chance to win the election. And I think if you put neutral people in a room and lock the door, Democrats, and say, hey, look, we have to put our most viable candidate who can win up there. I'm with you, Tom. It's John Edwards. And if they fool around with Clinton or Obama, those people can't go to Iowa and walk into a rural coffee shop and be accepted. It'll be like Dukakis riding around in a tank. And I just don't think that we're headed in the right direction. And I hope that people realize that how nice it, you know, I would love to wake up tomorrow and it be President Dennis Kucinich and Vice President Bernie Sanders. But you know as well as I, a ticket like that would get swamped. And so the Democrats have to get smart and nominate their most viable electable candidate.
Yeah, although the bottom line is that, tragically, because we don't have public funding of elections, which Bernie Sanders has been calling for 20 years now, and as have I, that money talks in this business. And it looks like an enormous amount of money is being raised by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And frankly, I am of the opinion that if Hillary ends up being the candidate of the Democratic Party, that she actually does have a good chance of winning, and she may turn out to be a very good president.
I have a question for you.
Yeah. Even though she's not my first choice.
Nor am I. I'm with you on Edwards. But just finish this sentence for me. Hillary Clinton will do better in Florida and Ohio than John Kerry because. And I don't think you can complete that sentence. I think that white-collar Democrats will defect in 10 or 15% of them. You know, the guy with the tattoo on his arm that's a labor guy is not going to be a big Hillary supporter.
I'm not sure that's true. And in part, you know, it's because of her policies and whatnot. I think a lot of us, and I think a lot of folks in the media, but I think a lot of us on the left are buying into the right-wing spin. I mean, Hillary has been redefined more by the Republicans and by right-wing talk radio over the last 20 years than by anything else. And she's out there trying to redefine herself. I think also her husband is a tremendous resource. If I had to answer that question right now, because Hillary has not had an opportunity to get out there and run her ads and everything, the answer would be because she's Bill's wife and he's going to be the first man, I guess.
Well, all those books, the books that are out now, and, you know, 90-95% of the stuff that they say about her is bogus and exaggerated. But nonetheless, it has a cumulative effect. And I think if people sense that there's any doubt about somebody, they tend to defect. And real quick, I thank you for letting me talk so long. Regarding Bloomberg and Perot and all those people that are third parties, they're all wonderful when they're the none of the above candidate. But when they get on the stage in a three-way debate, then they're not the outsider and people compare to them. And that was Perot's downfall, and that would be Bloomberg's downfall, too.
Yeah, though keep in mind, Perot pulled 19% of the vote. That's not insignificant. And in fact, there are a lot of Republicans who believe that George Herbert Walker Bush would have been president if Perot hadn't been on the ticket.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
You know, yeah, thanks a lot for the call, Marty. Good to hear from you. Dave in Buffalo, New York. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hello, Tom. Hey, rhetorically, was Sandra Day O'Connor paid off to step down? About your straw poll on Friday's show, may you consider having the poll on of the first hour so perhaps more of us can go or join in? I was kind of opted out on that with listening to Sirius. We only cover you on the first hour.
The other 2 hours are delayed, yeah.
Yeah, and then the second item, in the near future, you're going to have a program or two about Loose Change 9/11. And I have something to offer that hasn't been mentioned yet, and it may be important. And that is, when the plane comes over the left shoulder, and the building is struck.
Yeah, Dave, I'm going to stop you right there because if you continue, there's going to be another 150 people saying, "No, wait a minute, I want to get in on this argument," because that's what's happening in my email right now. As I said, we are going to do a program on this, and we're going to do it rather exhaustively, but we're not going to do it in pieces. Jerry in Wheat Ridge, Colorado. Hey, Jerry.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Boy, this. I'm just wondering why if Bush, if he's an illegitimate president, just tell me why Congress couldn't overturn all of his appointments, which would include.
Well, because he actually did get sworn in, and that established that's the measure of legitimacy. I mean, we can go back and historically say he was illegitimate, and it's conceivable that some sort of a legal process could be conducted in the House or Senate that might undo that. Although it's it's conceivable theoretically, it's not practically conceivable.
In Ohio, with the first. I've had two different petitions for writ of certiorari denied with the U.S. Supreme Court, and this second one, I feel so sorry for Ginsburg and Justice Breyer's, and she's really hanging in there. But anyway, it is absolute just. They're despicable the way they're.
Well, we have some really serious problems, Jerry, and I appreciate your calls. And the Supreme Court right now is turning out to be one of them. Alito and Scalia lied in their confirmation hearings, and they are voting in ways that are inconsistent with what they said they would do. And we should have known. I mean, we got a president who lied his way into office. We've got a president who has lied to the people, lied us into a war. Why should we be surprised that his Supreme Court candidates lied in their nomination proceedings? Mike in Chatsworth, California. Hey, Mike.
Hey, Tom. Big fan of your show. Listen, I've been talking to my kids, and they always ask me, is Bush the worst president that the country's ever had? And my feeling is that Ronald Reagan's really the one that did the most damage and started us down on this road. And I was wondering if there was any books or any good sources that I can give them to read about what really Ronald Reagan had done in his presidency.
Well, there was, you know, Haynes Johnson wrote a book called Sleepwalking Through History. At least 10 years ago it came out. Mm-hmm. And, it's been that long since I read it. It might even be longer than that. I think it came out when we first moved to Vermont, so that would have been like 12 or 13 years ago. And it chronicled the Reagan presidency pretty well. I think that we need, actually, you know, if I wasn't doing a radio talk show every day and I was back to, you know, writing books full time, that would be a great project to take on, would be the not just the history of the Reagan presidency, but its present day consequences, because it's grim. It's really,
yeah,
really,
it
really grim.
I mean, I live just off the Ronald Reagan Freeway, and it's painful to have to drive on that every day.
Yeah,
but I just
want
to keep, like, you know, and everybody still considers him a hero.
Yeah, well, not everybody. Not everybody. And what, you know, it's amazing. The media is all, oh, he was so loved when he was president. No, he wasn't. I mean, I remember that time. People thought of him as a cowboy. It was Ronald Reagan. You know, and he was not thought of as particularly bright. He was not thought of as a competent president, and by many Americans. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Hey, my friends, head over to airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page and join the Tom Hartman blog and start blogging. It could put you in the running for our daily giveaway at the end of today's show. My producer, David Poole, in his own inimitable fashion, will pick his favorite comment of the day from the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog. It's actually labeled Louise Hartman's blog. She starts it every day. It could be a serious comment or just a quick, funny one. That person will receive an autographed copy of my newest book, Screwed, The Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It. And by the way, our new book that we wrote on the air on this program last year will be out in a couple of months. It's up and available at tomhartman.com. There's a link over to amazon.com, Cracking the Code, about how to communicate politics. So I'm looking forward to that coming out. Anyhow, blog with us over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
How's everything?
Well, sorry?
How's everything?
Everything's pretty good in Washington, D.C. Everybody's abuzz with two things. They're abuzz with the Washington Post series on Vice President Dick Cheney and, of course, with the Supreme Court decisions, which I haven't read yet, so I can't tell you what I think about them. But I can tell you that Deputy Press Secretary Dana Perino described, you'll be glad to hear about this today, Justices Roberts and Alito as having intellectual vigor.
Yeah. Yeah, this is why we're getting 5-4 decisions. It's always the same five guys. And it's downright spooky. Now, tell this Washington Post series, decode this a little bit for me and for our listeners. I frankly have not had the time to read all of the two articles that have appeared so far, but my sense from what I have read, and I've read some rather extensive excerpts from them, is that Dick Cheney is a power answerable to nobody. Even the president's people, like Condi Rice, the examples that I've seen so far are Alberto Gonzalez, when he was Bush's lawyer, Condi Rice, when she was a national security advisor or director or whatever, and Colin Powell, when he was Secretary of State. All of them went on behalf of Bush up against Cheney, and Cheney won. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you do. You have that right. He won against all of them. He is far scarier than any of us ever imagined, far more powerful than any of us ever imagined, even when he suffers a defeat. I've just actually, when I was on hold, been reading from today's article, Story of a Defeat, when in one of the bills, the Detainee Treatment Act,
which was McCain's bill, which he lost 90-9. Well, apparently that was a rebuke to Cheney because the Senate voted 90-9 on that. Well, what happened was, nevertheless, they found all kinds of little adjustments that they put into the bill and managed to slip things through that way. If he doesn't get it through this way, he gets it through that way. He does it this way, he does it that way. He goes one way, he goes the other way. But if you cross him, you find yourself out.
Yeah, very, very much. Hang on just a second. What did you say, Chris? Dick Cheney on the line? Dick Cheney? Really?
You don't know the power of the dark side.
Yeah, quick, hang up on him. Okay, back to you, Victoria. I'm sorry.
Believe me, I'm in the White House in our booth, and I firmly believe that it's bugged. So I am not comfortable having this conversation.
Really? Are you being facetious or are you being serious?
I'm being serious.
Yeah, it's well. We're also on the air. It's about 2.5 to 3 million people listening right now. So
you know, I
felt like it's a secret.
I've forgotten that for a second. Yeah, it's all out in the open now.
Oh my! But you know, I mean, essentially, this is what the Washington Post is saying: is that Bush is impotent when he goes up against Cheney. I'm wondering, since Cheney was, you know, Bush asked Cheney to select his vice president for him or suggest vice presidential candidates, and Cheney suggested himself. I'm wondering if Cheney, from the very get-go, has had some power beyond simply that Darth Vader force of personality, some, for example, blackmail, that he has used with George W. Bush or possibly with the entire Bush family to insinuate himself into this highest level of power and forward his agenda. What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, some of it I get the impression that these are things that Bush actually wants to do.
Mm-hmm. But there's other times when, you know, Bush's people, I mean, Gonzalez and Condi Rice and Colin Powell go up, on behalf of Bush, go up against Cheney and they lose and Bush does nothing about it and Cheney's winning. And I mean, the series in the Washington Post is, at least for, as I said, from what I've read of it, is certainly making it seem as if the real president of the United States, or at least the most powerful governmental official in the United States, I was going to say the most powerful man in the United States, but I think probably there's a few corporate officers who fit into that category, but the most powerful governmental official in the United States is Dick Cheney.
Right. So that does come across. And you read about bills or orders getting to Bush's desk, which he then signs from Cheney, that have gone through no process. And you read about how process was very dear to Cheney's heart and how he advised previous chiefs of staff and vice presidents about process and how important it was. Or chief of staff, he advised, didn't advise any vice presidents.
Right.
But now he's completely gone around process. He pays no attention to it whatsoever because it gets in the way.
Unless it works for him. In other words, he wants everything coming to him to go via process, but anything that he wants to accomplish, he's willing to do in any way, you know, the means justify the end. Justify the means, excuse me.
That's right.
So he's the ultimate Machiavellian. I mean, it's...
He's the kind of guy who, if he was in the British court working for a king, you know at some point he'd lose his head.
Wow. Well, or he would be the king.
Yeah, I mean, one or the other.
Yeah, yeah. I could see, if he was in the British court and we were, you know, back in the 16th century, I could see that Bush would be the guy who'd end up in the Tower of London. You know, but who knows? I don't know. Anyhow, Victoria Jones, it's always great talking with you, Victoria.
Thanks very much.
Thank you for the report and your insights. And now Dick Cheney is tracking you around. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
So how do we wage peace? Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement, a new book by Scott Ritter, himself a trained warrior, a Marine, former weapons inspector, all-around good guy. Used to be, Scott, you identified yourself as a Republican. Do you still?
I identify myself as an American first and foremost. I'm still registered in the Republican Party. I'm a strong believer in a two-party system and would love to see the Republican Party return to some solid foundation that can be embraced by Americans. The current manifestation
of it. Good for you.
Nah, I reject the current manifestation of the Republican Party.
Yeah, I that's marvelous because I have been on in this program for years, and I wrote an op-ed a couple of years ago that has been very widely reprinted called "Republicans, Please Take Back Your Party." That you know, Barry Goldwater, who I went door to door for in 1964 at the age of 13, and Dwight Eisenhower, and I mean the Republicans, Teddy Roosevelt, certainly the real Republicans are rolling over in their graves right now.
Oh, Republican I agree. Yeah. I agree.
So your new book, Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement, there's an intrinsic contradiction in here. Talk about it.
Well, there isn't. I mean, on the surface, there appears to be, and it's been viewed by many in the anti-war movement as a contradiction. But as I point out in the opening pages of the book, you know, the anti-war movement needs to wake up to the reality that it is engaged in a life and death conflict. I mean, this is just the reality. They have an ideological opponent here in America. For lack of a better term, we'll call them the pro-war movement. You know, the ones that Eisenhower warned us about when he spoke of the military, industrial, and even at that time used another term, congressional, you know, the military-industrial complex, the military-industrial-congressional complex. You know, American society has been hijacked by this complex and has created an ideology of conflict, militarism, you know, corporate domination of the body politic. And that's our ideological opponent. Those of us, and I categorize myself as somebody who's in the anti-war movement, the progressive peace and justice movement, you know, the things that America's supposed to stand for. But we're in conflict. We can't pretend otherwise. I can guarantee that our ideological opponents don't view this as not being a conflict. They have organized themselves and they conduct themselves accordingly. And so far, they're decisively defeating the anti-war movement, the progressive movement in America. And so what I say is we need to wage peace with all the ferocity, not the violence, but the ferocity, the dedication that warriors wage war. And so if we're going to say we're in conflict, perhaps we need to turn to those who have mastered the art of conflict, the art of war, and see what they say about issues such as strategy, operation.
So your book is Lao Tzu. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Yeah.
You see, your book is the Lao Tzu for the anti-war movement.
Well, it's not just that. You know, the art of war, and I dedicate a chapter into, you know, talking about my roots as a warrior. I talk about, you know, the Marine Corps, and I point out in the 1980s, you know, it wasn't just Sun Tzu that we focused on. It was one of the books that the Commandant of the Marine Corps said all Marine officers must read. But we also need to read Clausewitz's On War. Many of us went further, read Jomini, a French general's book called The Art of War. We studied maneuver warfare as practiced by the Germans in World War One. Again, this isn't about taking a bayonet and jabbing it into somebody. This is about moving organizations. This is about motivating people. This is about identifying an enemy's weakness and best positioning your forces to dominate the enemy, to prevail on the field of conflict. We talked about an Air Force pilot, a guy named John Boyd, who was, developed the technique of being able to shoot down any airplane anytime simply by making quicker decisions, called the decision-making cycle. And we brought this all together into what we called the Art of War from the Marine Corps. And so I applied, you know, a Marine's focus on waging war to, you know, how would a Marine focus on waging peace? How would we go about? Or yes, so I just put down some of the fundamentals, the concepts of strategy and tactics, the differences. Many in the peace movement speak of their strategy of demonstrations. Demonstrations aren't a strategy. They're a tactic. And as Sun Tzu says in his book, you know, tactics without strategy is just a noise before defeat. And this is pretty much, I think, how we can encapsulate the anti-war movement to date. It's a lot of noise, but defeat nonetheless. We're not prevailing. Our nation's at war in Iraq. It doesn't look like we're getting out anytime soon. Congress has failed the anti-war movement by abandoning the base that got them elected. The rhetoric on Iran is ratcheting up. We've got a lot of work to do, and I think there is recognition in the anti-war movement that perhaps they're not as organized as they need to be, and that's why I wrote the book. It's not an how-to, meaning read it, it's going to say A, B, C, and you win. This is a fundamental thing. You know, it's like a football coach talking about the fundamental, not how to throw a Hail Mary pass, but blocking, tackling,
right,
ball
right.
handling.
What are the broad things? You talk about the indirect approach. You quote Sun Tzu in The Art of War. All war is based on deception, number one. Number two, the supreme excellence is to subdue the armies of your enemy without fighting a battle.
Without fighting.
And somebody should have told George that. And number three, and he will win, who knows when to fight and when not to fight. And you talk about counter recruitment as the antithesis of the indirect approach. Define these words for us and tell us how the anti-war movement can use them.
Well, the indirect approach, first of all, we need to understand that our opponent is better funded than we are. They have a lot of corporate sponsorship. They're already in government for the most part. And so to do the old frontal attack, the line up the armies on the field of battle and go at it, we're going to get ground
down. We're toast.
We in the anti-war movement. We don't have the resources to take on. So the indirect approach allows us to avoid decisive conflict on the enemy's terms and instead find areas where the enemy is weakest and exploit those and then wear the enemy down. It's a lot like a guerrilla movement taking
sure.
on a conventional armed forces. Again,
and those weak areas would be what?
Say again?
And those weak areas would be what?
Well, in this case, the weak area, I think we need to understand that one of the things that gives the anti or the pro-war movement its strength is the overall apathy of the American public. And since we're speaking of the American political battlefield here, I think the great weakness is in the pro-war movement is the lack of genuine involvement of the American public in the pro-war movement. They have disassociated themselves from the basic precepts of citizenship involvement, in doing so creating a vacuum that's been exploited by special interests. This is a weakness because the Constitution still gives the American citizen a say at the election booth. And if we can get the Americans motivated to participate in democracy, we'll fill that vacuum. And that wipes
out. Well, and Alexander Hamilton talked about how a noisy minority would always prevail over a quiet majority, or an uninvolved, I think it was his term, an uninvolved majority. It sounds like that's essentially what you're talking about. Scott, we only have a minute and a half or so left, and before we wrap up this conversation, I do want to ask you, I want to follow up on a conversation you and I had 6 months ago or so, in which you suggested that in the spring of this year we were going to see a U.S. invasion of Iran. And you wrote a book about this. The invasion hasn't happened yet. What's your current thinking on U.S. policy vis-a-vis Iran?
Well, I mean, the invasion has occurred. It just hasn't been a conventional invasion. The CIA is engaged in covert activity. The president's just signed a finding saying that regime change in Iran is the policy of the United States of America. Congress is spending $70 million of U.S. taxpayer money. We're spending, hundreds of millions of dollars to deploy American military forces down the road. Look, the president's having a heck of a hard time in Iraq. The nation, our nation's having a hard time in Iraq, and it's stretched our military to the extreme. But the intent of this administration continues to be regime change in Iran. They're defining Iran, the problem of Iran, as a nail, and therefore the only solution when you define a problem as a nail is the hammer. In this case, the hammer is the U.S. military. I still caution the American public that this is an administration that is very much focused on military action against Iran, and we cannot let our guard down just because the bombs haven't fallen to date.
Well, they haven't moved the aircraft carriers out of the Persian Gulf yet.
No, we haven't.
Yeah. So do you think that there's a possibility or a probability that they
will? Well, you take a look, even the Israelis, I use the Israelis as a benchmark, and the Israelis have basically said that they're willing to give the United States until the end of 2007 to resolve the Iranian nuclear issue, after which times it becomes critical. And the administration has pretty much bought into that. So that doesn't mean that there won't be military action in 2007. But, again, the problems this president's faced in Iran have made it more difficult to go to war right now. That doesn't mean he doesn't want to.
Yeah, amazing. Scott Ritter, his new book, Waging Peace, The Art of War for the Anti-War Movement. Must reading. Check it out. Scott, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, sir.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour on the Tom Hartman radio program on Air America.
listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
There's no other way to say it. We've been lied to and misled into another senseless war. How many thousands must lay dead before we wake up from this nightmare and revive the American dream? If we blindly stay the course, this horse will drown us in the stream. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrow's where it depend on what we do today. Don't stay the course on a horse that's going the wrong way.
Yeah, and speaking of the horse going the wrong way, I have said over and over again on this program, you know, for the better part of the, we're in the fifth year now of broadcasting on this show, and I have all along and consistently, and I've written about this in a number of op-ed pieces and in three of my books, suggested that one of the big problems we have in the United States right now is this concept that had always been operating, always been bubbling beneath the surface, but was really brought forward by Ronald Reagan in 1981, that the commons, that the stuff that we collectively own via government, the stuff that we collectively protect via government, that the commons should be in the hands of private for-profit corporations. It's called privatization. We're selling off our roads. And you look at all these big corporations, these big multinational corporations that are spending millions of dollars on lobbying to get to buy our highway systems, to buy our water systems, to buy our electric power systems. There's a reason why they want to do that. They want to make money off the commons. If you're talking about the stuff that people absolutely have to have in order to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, which is the essential stuff that the commons is made of, you're talking about stuff that they can't live without, then you're talking about stuff that you can make a whole lot of money on. Because you very much have people by the throat in that kind of a situation. And so, ultimately, it's a felony, a crime against democracy to privatize the commons. It is anti-American. It is, in my opinion, unconstitutional. It is certainly anti-constitutional. It is as anti-American as you can get to privatize the commons, to sell off the commons to private corporations. And that being the case, the most important of the commons is our government. And the way that we run our government, the way that our elected officials know how we want them to behave, because we're the ones who are the owners of this country. We're the ones who are the owners of the commons. We, the people, are the first three words of the preamble of the Constitution of the United States. This is our country, our government. We, the people. Liberals, conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, Greens, libertarians. It's we, the people. It's ours. Given that, the most important part of the commons, the part of the commons that should never be privatized, is the means by which we tell our government, our governmental officials, how we want them to behave. That is, our ability to elect them to office or not. The vote. The vote is the most vital of the commons. And privatizing the vote is the biggest felony against democracy. And this is why I'm opposed to Rush Holt's bill and Dianne Feinstein's bill and any other legislation that would allow private for-profit corporations to secretly record our votes and then, without disclosing to us how they know how we voted, tell us how we voted. And the reason I bring this up is because a Florida appeals court just issued a ruling today in the case of Christine Jennings et al. Versus Elections Canvassing Commission of the State of Florida. Case 1DO7-0011, the District Court of Appeals, 1st District, State of Florida, just upheld a lower court decision that denies
request for an independent source code audit of voting machines used by Florida's 13th district. This is from the Ars Technica blog, ArsTechnica.com. This all started when Christine Jennings lost to Vern Buchanan by 368 votes in Catherine Harris's district, which is made up of, as I recall, four counties. And one of those counties that is heavily Democratic, Christine Jennings being the Democrat, who lost by 368 votes, in one of those in the Democratic county, 18,000 people voted but did not vote for their candidate for the House of Representatives, for Christine Jennings or Vern Buchanan, which is impossible. 15% of the people in that one county all of a sudden just decided they're going to vote for everything except their member of the House of Representatives. And it was the county that would have made Christine Jennings the member of Congress from that district in Florida. And so this lawsuit was initiated to force ES&S, Election Systems and Software, ES&S, the voting machine company that Chuck Hagel used to be involved with, to force this company to provide source code access to independent auditors so that they could see what happened to those 18,000 votes. And ES&S has said, it's none of your damn business. And they're refusing to give it. And here now, a federal court, the Florida Appeals Court, has said, yep, trade secrets are more important than free and open and honest elections. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour. This is amazing. This Florida Appeals Court has basically said that the right of a voting machine company to have trade secrets, which, you know, is a legitimate right, trumps democracy, trumps the right of voters to know how their vote was collected and counted. I think it's really important and really time for there to be a strong movement in the United States, and particularly for us to be lobbying our members of Congress to say no private for-profit corporations in the voting booth, period. And if there are going to be voting machines, particularly for people with handicaps, where it's more useful, you know, it's easier for them to use, let those voting machines be owned by local government entities and be programmed using open source software in ways that are totally transparent and obvious to all. Not that we know how somebody voted, but that we know with confidence that their vote has been accurately recorded. By the way, the percentage of Americans who believe, quote, Saddam Hussein's regime in Iraq was directly involved in planning, financing, or carrying out the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001, the percentage of Americans who believe that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, is up to 41%. It's gone up 5 points since September 2004. Could this have something to do with the fact that the New York Times, the USA Today, all the mainstream media are now referring to the insurgents in Iraq as Al-Qaeda? And just when you think it's gotten as crazy as it can get, it gets just a little crazier. Just in case you marked out on your calendar like I had Wednesday night to watch Larry King Larry King show on CNN to see Michael Moore interviewed about his new documentary, Sicko. Well, sorry. Instead, Michael Moore has been bounced off the show and been replaced by Paris Hilton. CNN, the number one news, the number one name in Paris Hilton news. Yes, indeed. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Anthony in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Anthony, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to let you know, because you're right here in my neck of the woods. You're down in Portland. But a couple things. You just had Scott Ritter on, and he was talking about his book, Waging Peace, and he was talking about the fact that, you know, peace marches and stuff like that don't make a difference, or he, just to paraphrase, I guess.
No, he said they're not a tactic. He said they're not a strategy. They're a tactic.
And
he didn't say they don't make a difference.
And the thing is that, you know, we have to hold these people's feet to the fire. And on that end, I just wanted to let the people, at least in the Seattle and Portland area, know that Alberto Gonzalez is coming to Seattle on Wednesday to give a speech at 8:30 in the morning. And, you know, he's never been to Seattle before, and you know, WTO wasn't even on the political radar until this city put it on the map. And I just think that we need to let this criminal know that he is, number one, not welcome in our city, and number two, you know, his time has come. I mean, his ilk is just, they're not welcome, and they're just going to be a pariah in this country, even after they leave office.
And let's deal with it in a legal and nonviolent and appropriately political way. But, Anthony, yeah, thanks for the heads up. In fact, there's a piece over on Think Progress a couple of days ago about how that speech that he's going to be giving is being sponsored by an organization that promotes creationism and that promotes the Bible replacing the Constitution. Strange stuff. Very strange stuff. Joe in Penn Hills, Pennsylvania. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hey, first of all, I've been listening to you talk about the election, you know, elections, and I believe only in paper ballots.
Yep.
Keep the computers totally away from anything that has to do with an election. Totally away. Don't even give them a shred of light to work with, because that's totally corrupt. Next thing. When you reference Ronald Reagan, while he had a lot of bad things, there's a number of things which you forget. First of all, his vice president. The very first thing that happened when Ronald Reagan was in office of any significance was somebody tried to assassinate him. That individual, Hinckley, his family was personal friends of the Bush family. This is a fact. The press has totally glossed over it.
It was reported at the time. I mean, you know, it as one of those, gee, isn't it amazing coincidences, but it was reported at the time.
Really amazing coincidence. If you buy that and the fact that he was infatuated with Jodie Foster, and that's why he did it, you know, I got a bridge for you. The next thing, when George Bush was in office, he gave Saddam Hussein the green light to invade Kuwait through April Gillespie.
April Gillespie, yeah.
Right. Well, yeah. But Bush gave him Bush. It was through Bush. Gave him the green light. Go ahead, Glenn. He goes in, and because, as we both know, Kuwait used to be part of his empire. He went in. Bush goes over and attacks. He doesn't finish his job. His son gets in, and I'm telling you what, it's the most corrupt election ever happened in the United States. What's he do? He goes in to finish the job because, his own words, that man tried to assassinate my daddy. And those were his exact words. I think you're missing something really big here. It's how far this corruption goes back with the Bush family.
Yeah, well, and you can take it, and point taken, and you can take it all the way back to Prescott Bush and his work during World War II on behalf of Mr. Hitler. So, you know, it's a tough one. In Granite Falls, Washington, I'm sorry your name has fallen off my call screening software.
Pat.
But, hey, Pat, there you go.
Yeah, Tom,
what's up, Pat?
This is in reference to Scott Ritter. How do we fight with one arm tied behind us? And I'm making reference to our First Amendment and our freedom of the press. Now, I'm quoting, history records, the news media has developed into an unofficial fourth branch of the government that provides additional checks and balances by scrutinizing what government is doing and exposing corruption, unquote. Now, the Supreme Court seems to agree in 1964 in case of New York Times versus Sullivan. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the press. Now, in 1971, the Pentagon Papers and Nixon, the New York Times versus United States, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the newspapers. And, Justice Hugo Black wrote for the majority, quote, The press was to serve the governed, not the governors. Now,
right.
What has become
this is one,
of
this is
press,
one of the this is one of the reasons the press is referred to as the Fourth Estate, and it's
right.
And it's also one of the reasons why the press is the only industry. News is the only industry, the press is the only industry that is named in the Constitution of the United States and that
right.
is singled out for protection. And it's really critical that we have a free and vibrant press. And frankly, in my opinion, you cannot have competition and you cannot have freedom in an economic sense in a monopolistic system. And because Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act back in 1981 and thus leading to an era of mergers and acquisitions, corporations getting larger and larger and larger, these huge media combines, directly because of Ronald Reagan's actions, we no longer have a free press in the United States and we no longer have news. We have infotainment. And it's just, you know, it's just that simple. And the simple solution is let's start enforcing the Sherman Act again. And let's, you know, start breaking up some of these very, very large and massive corporations, particularly those that hold media in addition to other things. Carol in Mesa, Arizona. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Yeah, I'd like to talk again about the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
I've been concerned about that for quite a while, and I think it's actually even worse than you've said. Pretty much all the protections we've earned since the start of our country are eventually going to fall to this court as it is now.
Well, it seems that the five Catholic justices on this court, in opposition to the three Protestant and the one Jewish, or maybe it's two Protestant and two Jewish, as I recall, I forget which. And I make that religious distinction very carefully. I'm not trying to be anti-Catholic in this, but the fact that Scalia brought Thomas into his particular sect and his particular church and there's this whole little subsect, you know, under there.
Mm-hmm.
If you Google Opus Dei and Supreme Court, and you know, you'll get some surprising things. It's I am just frankly very concerned about the fact that several of these guys, Scalia in particular, have all but said that they're perfectly willing to use the bench to promote the ideas of their religion, and it concerns me, frankly.
Basically, we've already lost. And that, a lot of that is thanks to Lieberman and his Gang of 14, that the Roberts and Alito nominations were not able to be filibustered.
Yeah,
seven so-called Democrats, seven conservative Republicans.
Conservative.
It was a done deal.
And in part it was because the Alito and Roberts lied. They both lied under oath. They lied extensively under oath. And Clarence Thomas's there's this new biography about Clarence Thomas. There was a great excerpt or great review of it. Not this last weekend, but the weekend before last in the New York Times Review of Books. And they talk about, they go into great detail, at great length about how Clarence Thomas lied in his confirmation hearings. And if these guys aren't held to account for lying to be on the Supreme Court at some point, I mean, that's a terrible precedent to establish.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Just another poor boy out to fight a rich man's war. I'm an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue, the moon will land in Kandahar. I left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. I stack overdue bills and went off to save the world. It's been a year now, he's still here, chasing ghosts in the thin, dry air. We went back at home, fine as come and took his car. He's just another poor boy off to find a rich man's war.
And there's too many of them over there, I'll tell you. Jefferson said, I hope we shall never be a country where our young men will be willing to be shot at for a sixpence. What a tragedy has been brought to us by the likes of Reagan and Bush.
And we have selection. David has selected his favorite post over at the airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page blog. It actually says Louise Hartman's blog. Winner is Don the Hippie. Congratulations, Don. He says, when I listen to FDR speak, it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. Where is the modern day FDR? Someone to stand up for freedom and the common man. We should ask, what do we need to do to bring the new FDR out of the closet? There has to be someone who can communicate the political reality as effectively as he did. And here's a close runner-up. This is Doug Franks. Doug said, Ronald Reagan is as dead as FDR, yet the Republicans keep talking him up. Reagan is dead, but his policies are still around. And now we're going to do something about that. So, yeah, it's, well said. Well said. Although, you know, Limbaugh continues to say it's...
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan.
Yeah, good morning. Sort of been talking about strategy, as Scott Ritter was doing. And yeah. 2008 is huge, and the Democrats, you know, their strategy is, in some ways, it's little more than preaching to the choir. And the Democratic base, they're not doing the Democrats any favors. You know, they had the unrealistic expectations after 2006, and now they're talking as if, you know, they want to throw the baby out with the bathwater because the Democrats aren't doing what they wanted. I mean, and it's a marathon. 2006 was just to put the brakes on, and as you said about the Supreme Court picks and everything else, I mean, like, it's critical. And, you know, we're...
2008 is a big, big deal, and I was absolutely shocked when I was broadcasting from the Take Back America conference. And Dan, thanks for your call and your point is well made. I was absolutely shocked when I had on one of the consultants, one of the guys who's doing the polling, you know, kind of the Frank Luntz of the left, one of the major consultants to the Democratic Party. And I said, what are the Democrats going to run on in 2008? And he said, the war in Iraq. And I said, you're not going to have the war in Iraq as an issue in November of 2008. And he was like, yes, we are. And I said, if I'm right and you're wrong, what's your plan B? And he said, we don't have a plan B. We're going to run on the war in Iraq. And it's just going to be a disaster. It's going to be a disaster. The Democrats need to be talking about a whole lot of things beyond just the war in Iraq and beyond this culture of corruption, Republican culture of corruption. The Democrats need to be talking about what the traditional Democratic, large D Democratic and small D Democratic for that matter, the traditional Democratic vision of this country has been. Whether it's Thomas Jefferson who founded the modern day Democratic Party, even though the White House says that he and his protege Madison were Republicans. The Republican Party wasn't even created until 1856. Whether it's Jefferson's vision of America, or whether it's Franklin Roosevelt's vision of America, or whether it's, you know, on and on it goes. I mean, Jack Kennedy's vision of America, LBJ's vision of America, Jimmy Carter's vision, even Bill Clinton, as many disagreements as I have with him. It was a huge improvement over the conservative. We need to identify unambiguously how destructive and toxic the conservative Republican view of the position of America in the world and of the government of the United States relative to its own people is. We need to just lay it out unambiguously. Alan in Anaheim, California. Hey, Anaheim. Hey,
how you doing?
Hi, Alan. I'm great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Oh, no. It's funny. You always hear all these Republicans on the psycho Republicans, whether on TV or on the radio, do nothing but bash unions and bash the New Deal and everything. The problem is don't. I mean, yourself included, you're not the psycho Republican, but you guys are all either SAG or AFTRA, right?
I am. I'm AFTRA. Yeah.
Okay,
not all of us are, but yeah. I'm actually a member of two unions, AFTRA and also the Writers Guild, or the Writers Union, excuse me.
Okay, and then you always hear them trying to bash on all the unions and whatnot. Most of these guys, knowing the fact of, like, I know Hannity
You hear me bashing unions? Oh, you hear Hannity bashing. I don't know that Sean Hannity is a member of a union. They probably are not union members, Alan.
Really? I always thought that they would be, and generally, I mean, I remember Walmart.
I'd be very surprised if either Hannity or Limbaugh were members of AFTRA.
Yeah, because I remember some years ago when I was still working for a union construction company, when I hurt my back, one of the people in the office was telling me that like Walmart got in trouble for those commercials they used to do with like the employees and customers. They weren't paying them scale. They were going completely non-union. They got shafted for it.
Yeah. No, it's I would be amazed if any of the conservative talk show hosts are members of the union. So, anyhow, coming up tomorrow, conservative Devin Herrick and I will be debating if single-payer health care will be beneficial to Americans. You can guess what positions we'll be taking. It'll be a lively conversation. John Robb is here on his book, Brave New World, The Next Stage of Terrorism and the End of Globalization. Plus, as always, the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman radio program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. We got to get started. Get out there and get active. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.